A long time ago, in the underground realm, where there are no lies or pain, there lived a princess who dreamed of the human world. She dreamed of blue skies, soft breeze, and sunshine. One day, eluding her keepers, the princess escaped. Once outside, the brightness blinded her and erased every trace of the past from her memory. She forgot who she was and where she came from. Her body suffered cold, sickness, and pain. Eventually, she died. However, her father, the king, always knew that the princess's soul would return, perhaps in another body, in another place, at another time, and he would wait for her until he drew his last breath, until the world stopped turning.
Real Poets is an audio-only podcast that can also be visually read, like roses. Or when a director juxtaposes his or her most imposing reposes with characters, settings, and themes, composed of thrilling soundscapes, highest of stakes, and dreams. Hosted by a duo of real poets about real poets and the real poetry they've written and the films that have been written about them and their work.
Join us each week as we talk to another real poet with something to say and how a real poetry movie influenced them in some way. Then we each write a new poem inspired by our most recent viewing of the film and share it with all of you. Hi, and welcome to Real Poets. I am Renzo del Castillo, and as always, with me is my great, good, amazing, wonderful, talented, three-T'd friend.
I am Scott Raven. I like how I got downgraded from great to then good, and then I got talented, amazing.
But it's just the spectrum.
But all is
the
good.
Spectrum.
It is a spectrum. So you can be. Can one be both great and good?
You can be good at being great.
Possibly.
Or you could be great at being good.
True. And people can be great, and they can also be terrible, or terribly violent. But today, I'm Scott Raven. Raven, a horror poem. Today we'll be talking about somewhat of a horror fairy tale with the lovable Stella Amador. Amador coming from lovable, and Stella bloom by Stella.
Well, today we are discussing Pan's Labyrinth with the always great and genuinely good Stella Amador. She is the, just going to give a little intro here. Let's give her her flowers. She's a South Florida poet, founder of Wild Bloom Poetry, and creator of Bloom by Stella. That's a brand that offers intentional living tools centered on poetry, reflection, and nature. She hosts and curates Wild Bloom Poetry Open Mic at Emily's Garden in Fort Lauderdale, which is a monthly gathering that bills itself as the city's first poetry club, centering on presence over performance. And through Bloom by Stella, she created the Plant Your Life Planner, a reflection-based planner that blends poetry, prompts, and nature imagery to help people live with clarity, purpose, and intentional growth. She considers herself a secret poet for most of her life, who finally promised herself to show up at open mics, which is how we got to meet her and became friends, and then built a space that she could not find. And because I don't want to forget this, and because I'm not going to allow her to forget this, she also holds a bachelor's in psychology from Nova University. All that to say, we love Stella. We're so glad she's here. I think this is going to be a fantastic episode. And Stella has chosen Pan's Labyrinth. So why don't we kick it off there? Stella, why Pan's Labyrinth?
Yes.
First, thank you for that amazing introduction. And I love how you paused when you said the name of my book. So I so appreciate it because it gives it the time it needs to register that that's the name of the book.
Available for purchase. And we'll tell you where in the show notes.
Thank you. Pan's Labyrinth was a movie that I was obsessed with for when it first came out for like 10 years. And it was my go-to movie whenever somebody came into my life, or it was almost like a, have you seen this movie? Have you been in the world of Pan? You know, it was just one of those things that I always wanted to share with people or talk about. And when you invited me on to be part of this, I was like, torn between a few movies, but the one that kept coming back to me was Pan's Labyrinth, especially as Guillermo del Toro just made his all-time movie, Frankenstein, and I just watched it. So it brought me back to that as well. So thank you for having me and for that opportunity to share the movie with the rest of, you know, the world.
Guillermo del Toro is, you mentioned, maybe I'm remembering this wrong, but is he your favorite director or your favorite auteur?
He's one of my favorites. He's a close second with Pedro Almodovar.
Well, they're buddies anyway. So
they're buddies anyway. So the two of them make phenomenal movies, and movies that are always pushing the boundaries and showing us the light and dark of humanity and playing off of that, the theme of the duality as humans and how we can be both things. And the monsters that Guillermo del Toro builds are all based on childhood trauma, so he says. And it resonates a lot with me.
Great. So what I'm curious to hear is, you know, the intersection of kind of poetry with film and how this movie can be viewed as a poetic film. We also feel like, yeah, there is poetry in it. So before we kind of break into the film, I'd like to kind of hear your entrance kind of into the poetry world and maybe how you found poetry as a coping mechanism for some of the dark and harsh realities in your own life.
That's a very loaded question.
Yes.
I appreciate that, Scott. Well, I think I didn't know it was poetry until I was aware that it was poetry. I've been writing ever since I can remember. My mother recently showed me a box of letters I had written to her since I was able to write, and they were borderline poetic. I grew up in Nicaragua for the first 11 years of my life, and I come from a very artistic family. So I grew up around art, I grew up around music, I grew up around that kind of world that lends itself for creativity and imagination. And so I really resonated with that. Movies were, you know, part of our lives. Star Wars was almost like a religion for me and my brother. We watched it religiously every year for Christmas, the trilogy, of course, the originals. And so movies and storytelling were a big part of my childhood. And then I came to the United States, and all of that artistic legacy was left behind, and a whole new world of possibilities opened up for me. And I didn't know the language, so I learned English, and the very first thing I did is join a book club and then started writing poetry. And I wrote to process the changes that were happening coming from a world that was very different from the world that I was in. The realities of being an immigrant in this country as a child with two older brothers who didn't have the opportunity to go to school like I did. So all of those things became the cornerstone for the writings that would help me process what was happening, because I couldn't really talk to anyone. My brothers didn't understand my experience, neither did my mom, and the kids in school didn't understand me either. So I wrote because of all of that, if that makes sense.
Yeah. It does. Yeah. I want to dig into the secret poet a little bit. Because when I think of the film, you know, Ophelia, which is the protagonist of the film, and later we'll give a synopsis. I hope you've watched it, guys. But if you haven't watched it, we'll give a synopsis. But Ophelia is a child who moves between the brutality of Franco Spain, of, you know, Vidal, her stepfather's outpost, and this hidden labyrinth and fawn where there is danger, but there's also a sense of destiny and moral clarity. And I see a parallel to the immigrant experience you just described. I don't know what your specific story is, but I know that I left South America because of violence. South America has a very weak civil society. And when I say that, it's not a dig. I mean that in the sense that we were not allowed to develop a strong sense of civil society because we had colonialism until the early 1900s. And then we have governments that move from left to right, then left to right. And there was a lot of political violence. This inner life as sanctuary and resistance seems very close to your secret poet era and to maybe the reflective world created in the plant, your life planner. So could you tell us a little bit more about how this duality resonates in your work?
Oh, yeah, 100%. The entire time from the time I was 11 until about 3 years ago, I wrote in secret. I shared my poetry once in seventh grade with an English teacher who submitted my poetry to a state competition, and unbeknownst to me, I had won third place. That should have been a clue that maybe I should pursue this or maybe I should share more. But it did the complete opposite. I shelled up and said, oh, no, that's not something I can indulge in or entertain because I am an immigrant. I have the privilege of being able to go to school while my brothers are mowing lawns. I'm the only one who can get out of the system of interdependence. And so I became hyper focused on becoming financially independent and on building and getting a scholarship and going to school and, you know, being able to care for myself because I knew that I just didn't have the means or anybody around me who would be able to offer any kind of support other than the one I was already getting. And so that was my primary focus. So writing and sharing poetry felt super indulgent and impractical in the time that, you know, I was doing all these things. That was until about 3 years ago when I attended an open mic. I challenged myself because I'm an all or nothing person. So I went from like not sharing to like, okay, now I'm going to share and I'm going to share every chance I can get. So I gave myself a challenge and it was all because I heard of this woman who was a hospice nurse who interviewed people at the end of life and she wrote a book about it. And I'm not sure if you guys know about her, but she basically asked people what was their number one regret at the end of most people's lives. And their answer was super, super sad that they didn't live for themselves, that they lived for either someone else's expectations or society's expectations. And as someone who had been building other people's businesses and dreams and creating systems to help people build their dreams, that dream of the 11-year-old girl in me of pursuing art and sharing my work was, it hit me in the face. It was one of those things where I was like, okay, Stella, you can't be doing all these things without honoring your own passion and your own dreams. So I started sharing and I found places that I found that I fell in love with, like Miami Poetry Club, Arts Garage in Delray, or Oscar, the Biscayne Poets open mic. And those were places where poetry felt sacred and vulnerable. And that's what led to the creation of Wild Bloom Poetry and being able to hold the space where it wasn't about performance, but about letting that secret inner longing or inner dialogue breathe. Whether I agree or love it or don't love it, it's completely irrelevant. It's a space for it to be able to breathe and connect. And that was my mission. It continues to be my mission.
I want to let Scott ask a question, but I do want to dig into this because Wild Bloom Poetry, maybe some of our listeners are not familiar with Miami's poetry scene, but while Miami has been developing its poetry scene and it's made leaps and gains in the last couple of years, there really wasn't much in Fort Lauderdale, which is where you're centered, which is a bit north from Miami, about 20 something miles or 1,000 hours in Miami traffic, which makes you visiting and coming down to Miami for these open mics such a great, great thing and something we appreciate because we enjoy your presence there. There's this sense of creation of community that because we've become friends and we've had conversations that I feel from you, like you're always focused on creating a space so that others can have a platform and a voice. Can you walk us through the creation of Wild Bloom Poetry and why you felt it was necessary in Fort Lauderdale?
Because I had been traveling. So I'd go to Delray, I'd go to Miami, I'd go to Coconut Grove, I'd go all over. Even when I traveled outside of Florida, I would try to find a space. Like one of my best friends lives in DC and I would go to Bus Boys and Poets or any other open mic. And they're amazing and there's great spaces. And it wasn't that Fort Lauderdale, at least not that I know of, didn't have the spaces. They were all either mixed open mics, which had a variety of different genres like comedy, music, and then poets. And my experience with them is that the poetry was always kind of like, okay, let's get the poets out of the way and get to like the fun stuff. And that kind of left me feeling, as someone who was sharing very deeply sacred, vulnerable stuff, it left me feeling a little underwhelmed. And so I didn't see anything like that in Fort Lauderdale. Not that it doesn't exist. If it does, please hit me up. I'll go to it. But I didn't find it. And so I wanted to create that here. I felt called to create it. And it came out of, I had published my book I'd spent 9 months in solitude, working, putting my head down, going to yoga, going really deep inward and putting a puzzle together to, okay, I'm done. I published it. I promoted it. I'm going out and promote it. How else can I build community outside of that? And how else can I be of service? How else can I create a space where people can have the opportunity that I've had, maybe that can't drive to Miami or can't drive to Delray? That's how Open Poetry came about. And it was a conversation I was having over a coffee with at my friend's bakery. I said, you know, he said, what's next? I was like, well, I really like to do this. And he said, well, we'll open up for you. And that's how, you know, at Stephanie's Vegan Bakery, shout out to Manny and Stephanie, they opened their doors for us outside of their operating hours. And after the second event, I think you were the second poet, the last poet there. We were maxed out of space and, you know, I had to look for somewhere else.
Right. And then you have expanded. To echo Renzo's sentiments of it being an inviting safe space, of course, for different styles and the amount of active listening that is happening that those other art forms don't always lend themselves to, where people are hearing every word, both individually as well as the thought and the heart behind them. I'm curious, now that you are, you know, kind of curating and running an event, though, does the writing, I don't know if it interferes, but how does that work in tandem with kind of the putting on of an event? To me, I go to the poem itself is my safe place. You're hearing other experiences as well. How are you finding balancing, I guess, the creating as well as the putting on of events?
I don't really have a writing practice, if that's your question. I've never really sat down to try to write something. These last couple of months have been a nice, different challenge for me, like things like Real Poets and having to write a poem about a movie and sitting down and actively trying to write something is foreign to me. Same thing with Papa Poetry. Shout out to Kenny and Crystal, who challenged me to write a poem about, you know, absurdism as a whole or the pieces that were there. That's very challenging for me. I don't necessarily know that that is my best work because usually things just kind of get stuck. It almost feels like an 800-pound gorilla on my chest that I need to massage out of. And that is what my writing practice is. So I don't ever worry about inspiration, creativity, where it's coming from, how long it's taken since I wrote my last poem. They come. They've come my entire life. And I don't think about how many poems I wrote or do I have to write. I don't know if that makes sense, but that's sure.
But you're being, right. Process. But you're being incentivized by these events. You know, like I always know when I had hosted an event, like, all right, I want to have something that I'm going to bring to this event. And, you know, previous to, you know, you said you were the secret poet, you're holding on to your work. And now, you know, being able to be out with that, it ties into the movie a little bit where like, it's not an escape from the harsh realities. It's a confrontation of them. The writing of something can be an escape if it's never shown to somebody or brought forth to a wider community. Are there things that you still decide to, I guess, keep close to the chest? Or are you now like, all right, what's in me is coming out?
I don't judge my poetry. That's also one of the things that I don't try to fit it into a mold or a style. Whatever comes out, and I'm always surprised sometimes. Well, what comes out, I'm almost, there's this quote I recently read, something about the poetry comes to me as, and I'm its caretaker. I'm not the actual one that has to think about it. It comes and I get to care for it, and I get to be the steward of the words, of the feelings, of the things that come out. To your point though, what has happened because I've been attending these poetry events and meeting amazing poets such as you and Renzo, I am inspired and I am picking up on different energies and different styles, and playfully maybe they go into my subconscious because during one of my recent travels, a new level has been unlocked and the writing has been completely different since that trip, and I can't figure it out other than there was a blood moon, there were cats, I was in Dubrovnik, and ever since that eclipse, that lunar eclipse on the other side of the world, my poetry has been very, very different. And I think it was a combination of having access to different poets that I didn't have before, and also being in a space of openness where I'm not no longer holding anything in. It's all unlocked and open.
That's interesting to me, because Plant Your Life Planner, you are, and we're going to talk about it later when you're promoting your upcoming event. Scott and I are going to take part in this nature-themed event you're hosting in January of next year. Nature as a guide and witness is a huge part of this movie. The labyrinth, the roots under the tree, the mandrake root in the milk, the forest around the mill, they all function as living presences that shape Ophelia's choices. You just talked about the moon shaping your current poetic output. I know for a fact, because I've read your work and I've heard you before, it tends to be filled with nature as a metaphor for growth, for resilience, maybe even quiet transformation. This is, again, not, I'm not saying you say this, but this is what I interpret from your work. And then the film's earthy root level imagery kind of lines up with the plant metaphors, the seeds blooming, wild bloom that you use in your brand and planning framework. From your perspective, how do you see, there's a great tradition of nature influencing poetry, even as like, I wish that I would never see a poem as lovely as a tree, right? Like even to that basic level that we learned in elementary school, how has nature influenced your work and your output? And could you dive a little bit deeper? You already said the blood moon changed everything. Why?
I grew up with a grandmother who painted, and she painted nature. So since the moment I can remember, I was her shadow. I followed her everywhere, and I was a witness to her beautiful, amazing art. And we were best friends. And so that experience of going to parks, and we had a farm, and she would sit for hours, and I would meditate with her. And I would just sit in awe of this reflection. She would take nature, and she would take pieces of nature and create these beautiful paintings. And so that influence, I think, has stayed with me throughout my life. And I'm not a very religious person in the traditional sense, but I am incredibly spiritual and respect nature at all levels. I was vegan for about 9 years. I'm now a little bit more vegetarian, but very strict. And I love animals. As some of you may know, I have four dogs, one in heaven. Now I have a dove. Yeah. Shout out to Daisy. So I am a nature lover. Obviously, I love flowers. And the metaphor, we call it a metaphor, but we are nature. We tend to forget. And I think the conveniences of the world that we live in, and culturally, there's been this departure from our natureness. I don't know if that's a word, our naturalness. Anyways, I make up words too.
Shakespeare did it all the time. You're allowed.
I do. I know. I make them up. If there isn't a word that now it's invented. You heard it here first, real poets. That disconnection causes a lot of friction in the human psyche. It creates a lot of anxiety. It creates a lot of friction that is unnecessary. And when we try to force things in life, it's because we are going against nature. And so our natural state of being is to commune with nature, to be in nature, to be part of nature as we are meant to be. So all of my work reflects that. My poetry reflects that. The way I walk and move through the world reflects that. So I honor the moon, the sun, the birds. I honor the seasons. I honor the seasons as a person. And I move through the world with that at the forefront. That has been the catalyst for basically everything that I do.
We all came from the pouch of Pachamama. That's right, Mother Nature. So, well, what I'm interested in exploring through this, very, very well said, Stella, is also the influence of nurture as well. As we will explore in this film, there were some evil stepmothers and evil stepfathers, and how upbringing and family also play into one's writing. I know we write a lot about our dreams. I'm going to turn dark a little bit real quick, and I want to ask you about your nightmares. Do you remember any nightmare from childhood?
Absolutely. The biggest nightmare that was a recurring nightmare that happened to me was me being in my bed, it being dark, and me feeling like I couldn't move. The impotence of mobility, being frozen and being aware that I could not move. This would happen very, very often. And it happened for about 10, 15 years randomly. And it was this feeling of lack of being able to move and being paralyzed. When I would wake up, I had this weird sense that it wasn't a dream, that it wasn't a nightmare, that somehow my body was trapped in between dimensions, that either I was coming back from a trip abroad or another dimension and I was stuck, or something was holding me back. Anyways, that was a recurring nightmare that I had. And I would wake, and sometimes the last time it happened, maybe it was a year ago, and it hadn't happened in like 10 years. And my boyfriend, who you all know, Zoli, heard me crying in my sleep and had to wake me up. And I had to tell him this story. And I had to say, please, if you ever hear me crying and begging to be woken up, wake me up. Don't be scared. Wake me up, because I'm having one of those weird dreams. But yeah.
Sounds like a trap.
Yeah, wait, Renzo, can I throw that on you of sharing a nightmare, actually, too, just to parallel? And you've had a nightmare, and whether you've confronted it, maybe it was one that no longer plays, or you still have.
Yeah, I can tell you. I think I might have shared this in another episode, but I'm not sure. But when I was a kid, I'm not scared of death. Maybe I read too much Peter Pan, right? To Die is Another Great Adventure. I'm not scared of heights. I'm not scared of any of that stuff. But I am terrified of eternity. So when I was a kid, my dad took me to see my grandfather's grave when I was around 3 years old. And he apparently explained to me, like, yeah, your grandfather's in there. And the next night, my mom said that I woke up crying, saying, I don't want to spend eternity in a box. I don't want my dad to spend eternity in a box. I don't want my grandfather to be stuck in a box. And they took me to a therapist and, you know, I guess we worked through it. But I remember being like 7 years old, 8 years old, and I would try to go to sleep and I would see like a figure eight in my head. It would freak me out, because to me, it's like, it's very Blakean in a way, right? Like a rose is only beautiful because it's finite. How, if everything keeps going on and on and on and doesn't end, does it have meaning? Does it have value? Does it have this? So to this day, I'm not scared of it anymore, but I'm a little freaked out by that concept of unending existence. So that was a legit nightmare. I could picture that figure eight in white just in my head as a kid. What about you, Scott?
Does space frighten you? Like outer space? The endlessness of it?
Nah, like Stella said, Star Wars is a religion. That doesn't freak me out.
Oh, yeah.
No. But what about you, Scotty? Nightmares?
Yeah, I was trying to think. I mean, I definitely had nightmares growing up. I had night terrors. I'd wake up yelling quite often. And it kind of, you know, it stopped different periods of time when, you know, whether I was with another person in bed. And what I can really recall is a figure standing over my bed for, you know, where it was like kind of while I was asleep, but kind of while I was up, I would wake up screaming. And, you know, I was told that it was my grandfather at a time. And then I just remember one time just having the courage to just pop out of bed and like confront what was hanging over my bed. I convinced it was laundry on my rocking chair that was at the foot of the bed. Kind of like the movie, it was shaping into kind of different figures depending on how it was draped over that particular rocking chair. So I've learned from that, though, like, all right, even if I'm so scared, stand up to reality. If I'm in bed, like, stand up to it. I'm not coming at it with violence. I'm just acknowledging its existence in front of me, which had helped me move through it. Another quick one, which I think Renzo might enjoy, is, I think it was You Only Live Twice, the Bond movie.
Yes.
Where there is Bond sleeping next to one of his lovers and somebody comes in with like
a droplet of
poison, and it's supposed to like go onto Bond's lips and he'll instantly die. And I was terrified for years thinking somebody was going to open my window and drop this little droplet on my lips while I was sleeping. And all it took, though, was I think my brother, who just told me, you know, Scott, it was just orange juice. And he was acknowledging that the film was kind of made up and it was just orange juice. And then I was like sleeping and then thinking, oh, it's just orange juice. That helped me. But in the movie, I think the lover actually.
It just so happened that Michael was deathly allergic to orange juice. But no, yes. Now I feel so much closer to you, Scott, that you acknowledge your Bond fandom here on the screen. But I do want to get back to the film, right? Because Stella's work is about inner life, courage, maybe even slow courage and nature as a guide. And Pan's Labyrinth is about a child whose inner world becomes a survival strategy, maybe even a moral compass inside a really violent regime, right? So I'm just going to take a second. I want to read a short synopsis for our listeners and just to recap and then go on from there. So in 1944, in Francoist Spain, 10-year-old Ophelia travels with her pregnant mother to live with her new stepfather, Capitan Vidal, a sadistic army officer hunting anti-fascist resistance fighters. While the adults are consumed by war and control, Ophelia discovers an ancient labyrinth and meets a faun who tells her she may be a lost princess from an underground kingdom. To return to this hidden world, she must complete three dangerous tasks that blur the boundary between reality and fantasy. The film weaves together harsh political violence and a dark fairy tale imagery to explore innocence, sacrifice, and the cost of disobedience. This movie came out in 2006. It was filmed in Spain and Mexico. It's written and directed by Guillermo del Toro, produced by Guillermo del Toro, also by Alfonso Cuarón, one of his other buddies, and some others. It starred Ivana Baquero as Ophelia, Sergi Lopez as Captain Vidal. He had a really great movie. I can't remember the name of it, by the way, but it just came out this year as well. Maribel Verdú from Y Tu Mamá También as Mercedes. Adriana Gil as Carmen, the mom. Doug Jones, big shout out to Doug Jones, as the Fawn and the Pale Man. Cinematography by Guillermo Navarro. Music by Javier Navarrete. That score is fantastic. The reason I want to talk about this movie here in Real Poets as well, when you suggested it, is that I find that it is heavily influenced by Federico García Lorca. For those of you who are not familiar, he was a Spanish poet, and he used to blend the culture of Spain with a folk myth, political violence, maybe even fatal beauty. He used a style called duende, and he had an obsession with children, the moon, definitely the moon, blood, and earth. And that really aligns with the imagery in this film. To me, this is almost one of his poems turned into cinema. You have a little girl in a rural landscape, fascism pressing in, and surreal creatures that feel, God, don't they feel inevitable instead of whimsical? Like just the meeting with the faun. So I want to start there. What poetry, Stella, do you find in this film?
It's all poetry for me, even as I can remember watching it, thinking the in-between worlds, the time of going into this creative, imaginative world as a means of not only, not just survival, but of understanding the world. And I think the part that I love is nature as a guide. And that world that she taps into is nature. It's going under the tree. It's going into the labyrinth. It's the fairies who aren't really fairies, who were, you know, an insect, and then it turned into a fairy to match her desire of wanting that tangible imagery. So it's all poetry. Even the language that is used, you know, there are certain instances where, and I could have used some of this in my poetry, and I'm looking at my notes. Father is just a word, you know, and it kept coming back over and over, and the names. And, you know, Guillermo del Toro is incredibly detailed. Everything is purposeful. The names of the characters are purposeful. Mercedes, the woman who helps her, the woman who becomes almost like a surrogate mother in the midst of all this, it's mercy. It's mercy coming to aid her. Ophelia was named after, you know, Shakespeare, Shakespeare's Ophelia. So all of that is all poetry. And I didn't know the extent of it all until I rewatched the movie recently and I dug deep. But when I watched it, it struck me. I think that's why it stayed with me for so many years. The imagery, the wonder and the awe, and also the brutality of it all. Both worlds mirrored each other. There's the scene of the banquet where you see all of this gluttony and all of this food laying there. And there's also a scene in the real world of the movie where they're hoarding the resources that they've confiscated and that they're putting into a warehouse or, you know, some kind of makeshift warehouse where they're storing everything and they're rationing food for the people. And so all of that, I think, is a form of poetry. The story she tells her brother when, you know, she's speaking to him in the womb, that's a poem. at least the way I see it. So
I remember that scene, and I took it as a really big criticism of Catholicism in Franco's Spain, just like you see the priest feeding himself, gorging, and then the pale man is, I've read, and I also assumed that he is a representation of religion having a feast before him and eating children instead, just devouring the youth of Spain. But Scott, what do you think of that scene?
I've not been viewing it through the lens of being as much a historical allegory as much as a fairy tale, an exploration of fairy tales in a dark manner. Like you mentioned Catholic Church, you mentioned the Civil War, and that is at the backdrop, but he's more alluding to fairy tales that explore these things than the historical periods themselves in a lot of instances. It's kind of a layering of fairy tales from through an even more, you know, darker lens. Yeah, if I look at it through that, there is Grimm's fairy tales and you know, I mean, you go Mother Goose, you know, Hansel and Gretel, Little Red Riding Hood, you know, kind of the Big Bad Wolf, all these poetic kind of images that come to mind. What poem came to me, it's interesting that you thought of Lorca. I'm thinking of Borges, who wrote Labyrinths. That was just kind of the infiniteness of time and the universe, something that I like to kind of like explore. I was also looking up kind of like, yeah, what were some other horror poems out there? It reminded me of, I don't know if you've heard of Robert Graves, the one about a child's nightmare, I believe, where there's kind of this repeated phrase of this animal. I think it's cat. Yes. And for those to check out, that's kind of the poetry that I found within it.
Well, let's go back to fairy tales and folk tales. This has a classic quest structure. There's three tasks that she has to fulfill. There's a dangerous feast. There's forbidden fruit. There's tests of obedience. There's rebellion underneath all this. The film behaves like an old tale told in a new, darker time, similar to how contemporary poetry write myths to speak to modern trauma. But do we? Because if you think about all of these Disney versions of fairy tales we've grown up with, you mentioned the Brothers Grimm. They are much darker. If you think of The Little Mermaid, Ariel doesn't end up with Eric with her father's blessing. Ariel refuses to murder Eric, who married another woman. Her sisters cut their hair off to buy a knife, and she gets rid of the knife and melts into sea foam. Snow White and Briar Rose, also another dark tale. These tales are not what we grew up with. I think there's a history of dark horror being used to instill morality in us as children, that fear is the tool that is used to inculcate morality. When I see Guillermo's work, it is a rejection of religion. It is a rejection of the way things are, of the standards of what's proper. And it is more of a think for yourself, act differently. I mean, I'll be honest. When I first watched the movie, I've always loved it, but I was really annoyed by Ophelia because I'm like, this girl has no personality. And I'll tell you how I changed my mind in a second, but it was more like she's blank. She's not even, the journey's not even, she's benefiting from fascism. And now her moral choice to move away from it, now it's a challenge. Now it means something. As I rewatched it this time, it's almost like, I think I told you this, Scott, in an offline conversation we had. It's like Legend of Zelda, Link. It's almost like she's a blank slate so that we could put ourselves in her shoes. I still think there's some things that could have been, maybe Guillermo didn't really care about, like, oh, she now cares about her little brother at the end when she couldn't give a damn about him either way at the beginning. She was about to leave him to run away. There's some things there. No, please, you can disagree. But I'm saying, like, for me, there's some things there. But now I believe that maybe because I am a fan of Guillermo, I consider him a master storyteller. And I felt myself being more in the shoes of that character. Where am I going to go? What choice would I make? What will you do? But when you're presented with that amount of darkness, do you escape to another world? Or is it a painful catharsis of the merging of those two worlds to live your truth? And that's where I'm with it right now.
What's hard to reconcile is that this is not a kid's movie. This is an R-rated movie. And you are asked, can you put yourself in an 11-year-old's shoes with which to see this movie? But you're not. Like, you're Renzo now at your age. And I loved the movie the first time, and I had difficulty this time because, as I mentioned with Wings of Desire, I watched the movie through the eyes of my newborn baby. This time, I was trying to avert my child's eyes from watching this movie because of how horror it is. I was just like, okay, I'm trying to rewatch, and I'm turning his head at many moments and realizing, as you mentioned, these Disney fairy tales, like, yeah, they are palatable to the, I guess, under 10 age bracket. This clearly not. What I would like to open the conversation to, though, is like, and I know, Renzo, you have some tales about this as well. Like, what age are you ready for the violence and the cruelty of the world? You don't want to seek it out. You don't want to expose somebody to it unless they happen to be in it. I know that for me, I was writing about this. It's more of a Peter Pan's labyrinth for me, because I want to be thinking happy thoughts with my kids at this age until I'm ready for them to come into the horrors and the cruelty of this world. Now, that isn't to say maybe their minds may go there.
I mean, I want to ask Stella about this. This is also about a woman's place in society and a woman's place in the world.
Yes.
And so, Stella, could you dig into that? I mean, what do you think about all this?
Oh, my God. I have a lot of thoughts about it. So first of all, I want to say I love the Zelda reference. I am a huge Zelda fan. Also, Scott, to your point, which age is it the right age? I think the point of his movies are very much about the monsters of real life and the tragedy and trauma of childhood. He writes from his own childhood trauma. So I don't think there's a right or wrong answer to that. But I do believe that there is a big portion of society and children who are exposed to unspeakable plights. And unfortunately, that is a part of life. And he's shining a light on that. Is there's beauty in the horror. That's what I want to say about that. And Renzo, to your point, I had, as watching it now, I haven't watched a movie in a long time. As a 42-year-old woman, with everything that is going on in the world, I was very angry watching this movie, but also redeemed by Mercedes' character, which was a beautiful ending to the movie. Her last line was just brilliant and the cherry on top. But I'll start with the thing that like moved me, that I wrote down, that was very... It hit me in a way that I wasn't expecting when I rewatched it, which was when Ophelia goes to meet the captain and the mother says, "You must call him father. Father is just a word. He's being good to us." And her submission and passing that on to her daughter. Big red flag for me there. Then there was the introduction, which was she gave the wrong hand and he squeezed it really tight. And it was like a crushing of innocence that came to me as well. And it wasn't just the wrong hand dealt, but it was the wrong gender and it was not his. And those were the themes that came up. The next scene that bothered me was the wheelchair, the wheelchair being brought to the mother, who can walk perfectly well. And she's pregnant with, to give some reference to the listeners, she walks perfectly well. And suddenly, as she comes to her new husband and she's pregnant, he brings a wheelchair and demands that she sits down. And her lowering herself and relinquishing her autonomy started there. It was very, very much the theme of her interactions with, you know, the captain and her husband. And the counter to that was Mercedes. Mercedes' anger to not be part of the revolution, to be serving this man, to be in the place of servitude of someone she was vehemently against, resonated very much with me. So this entire movie was about the subservience and the secondary nature and the place of women in that subset of society, but as a whole. That was something that I wanted to make sure that we talked about as well. So thank you for asking, because it really, I think it permeates that we're in a time and place where all of those things are coming up again, even though we've made tremendous progress over the last 50 years. And we're now being asked to some degree to take a back seat or to be subservient to some degree. And that's also a horror, to say the least. But I mean, I can talk about this all night, but please.
But no, I Let's talk a little bit about the mother, Carmen. It seems that she is a beautiful woman, but her value is just beauty is her commodity and how she's able to survive. I don't know about you guys. Let's take a quick survey. Who thinks that Captain Vidal had something to do with Ophelia's father's death? I think he had that man killed. I straight up think he had that man killed because he had something he wanted and he took over. Her currency is beauty and her currency is what her appearance, which he cares very deeply about, how he is perceived. And that's Ophelia's role model until we get to the character of Mercedes, who is subservient, but for a purpose. And she's there because they won't suspect her. And you see the steel that's inside of her when she gets kidnapped by or taken by Captain Vidal and is about to be interrogated. And he's going through his whole performance. And she's like, do you think I'm a poor handicapped stuttering boy or an old man? And she cuts him and scars him and makes him feel the pain. But then that's also who is now taking care of Ophelia. And she has these two female figures in her life. But then she also has the Fawn, who is a bit of a mentor. And we can get into that in a little bit. I do really want to explore the Fawn. But I want to focus on little children right now because Ophelia is this girl navigating survival in this world. But the captain is also a lost little boy who's obsessed with what his father expects of him as a man. His life is dictated by the watch that he always carries, but how he is perceived, by what he can do. He doesn't even seem to have the empathy to know that his actions cause pain and take so much from people. And to your point, at the very end, when he is finally defeated by these forces, who, by the way, will be wiped out. Franco's rule lasted for way longer than this movie. They will be eventually wiped out. But when he is confronted and he's like, well, tell my son, like, I'm going to face this like a man. And you tell him what hour, he's like, she won't even know your name. And it's this critique and deconstruction of toxic masculinity, but it is also this critique and deconstruction of the roles women play in society. And to me, it's fascinating. Like, I'd love to know what you guys think about this.
The line when she's left alone with him and he says, oh, you can leave. What is she going to do? She's just a woman. Oof. I think of all the times women throughout history, still today, continue to be underestimated. We make up 50% of the population, roughly. And so it's really a testament of that toxic masculinity, that generational, like, this is the way things have always been, this is the way that they should be. And the value of Carmen comes from her ability to procreate a male heir. That's all he cares about. Her well-being is directed towards protecting that male heir that he covets because it will continue a legacy of that masculinity. Living his father's expectations and his father's dead. So that whole dimensional, like one dimensional, when he's looking at himself in the mirror and he's, you know, almost like cutting himself. There's a lot of that in my poem and you'll hear it. The subservience, the role of women having to placate and the having to put on a role in order to survive. That is our history.
And the violence done against women. He straight up shoots a little girl in the stomach. Getting shot in the stomach is an extremely, I haven't experienced it, but I have read and I have heard accounts that getting shot in the stomach is an extremely painful way to die. There's a lot of commentary on the violence that is also done against women.
The violence is inevitable because when you are considered subservient and you are a second class citizen, and there's jokes about this. I don't know if you guys saw Borat, you know, there's dog, you know, there's cow, there's men, there's dog, and then there's women, you know, at the very bottom of the totem pole. When you take out the humanity, whether that is of women or traditionally marginalized communities, it is a lot easier to be cruel to them. It is a lot easier to inflict pain and trauma on people that you don't see as equal, even animals, which I can talk a lot about that. But yes, there is a tremendous amount of violence, both psychological and, I mean, what he does with her from the very onset is a shutting down of you. There's everything wrong about you and your existence. And that begins her journey of discovering how she can be disobedient and rebel against that force that is pushing her. It's like, you are irrelevant. There is no relevance to your existence anymore. You are here in my world. And in this world, I am the captain. So there's a lot of, I'll share because we are in a space of poetry and poets are much more sensible. You know, my mother suffered physical abuse at the hands of my father, which is the reason why we left. We talked about violence and leaving violent countries. My mother left a violent marriage and we had to leave the country to escape the stigma of divorce. And one of the reasons I'm not religious is because I grew up in a Catholic church, and where my mother divorced, they shut the doors on us as a family, as a divorced woman. We were persona non grata everywhere we went. So there's a lot of violence inflicted, but also the remnants of that violence is the children. What happens to the children? And as someone who had two older brothers who intervened in a lot of these physical altercations, there's trauma that goes beyond what anybody can recognize. And you can see people walking around carrying it all the time. And I think that's where nature and the fawn comes in and all of these things that can help heal some of that. I don't think you could ever erase that, but it definitely helps to heal it.
Scott, I want you to weigh in on this, but I do think it's time to talk about the fawn, because the fawn does help heal it, but he treats her with violence. He screams at her in order for her to be worthy of getting to a place. So I'm still unsure of what Del Toro is trying to say with that, but I do think that the price that children pay with their innocence sometimes may not be worth it.
Is the fawn another type of disciplinarian, but not as evil as Vidal? There's so much to say. First, thank you for sharing that with us, Stella, and about the violence. You know, you do have the, like your brothers, the doctor becomes outside the realm and steps in, has that quote about obedience. Vidal, it got to be one of the most evil MFs in movie dub. The level of cruelty that really just does drive it home. I'm also interested in the idea of princesses, which we haven't really touched upon. Ophelia being a princess and kind of what, you know, if we're supposed that she created, this is a mythical realm within hers. Did she want to become a princess, or is that kind of traditionally princesses have a bit of more of a subservient role, but you know, she is actively on the quest. The first Disney movie to do it, I don't know if you saw Brave. Did anybody see Brave? I don't know if that was Disney or Pixar. Right.
I watch all of it. I did see it.
Yes. Where this badass princess that is actually fighting, you know, is she, I believe, Irish in that?
She's Scottish. She'll be fighting for her own hand.
That's right. And what struck me is, of all the fantasy movies, I can't really think of that many female protagonists, at least the 80s, 90s at all. I mean, if we think of Labyrinth and Neverending Story, I mean, Labyrinth, Fottle becomes the main. She's just kind of still the babysitter, but I guess she is a bit of a badass babysitter. Or she's a mom in Labyrinth, right?
No,
I can't remember.
She's the protagonist for sure. It's all about her finding her way back to her little brother. And we can talk about Labyrinth another time, but that's another movie. Yeah, there is a big, very big parallel. She is definitely the protagonist of that movie and quests through and goes and realizes that, you know, she does want her brother and she does want to, like, all these things she criticized, she does miss. She goes through her trials to figure out that what she's rebelling against, she really loves.
Right. And then Neverending Story, there's some parallels to, I believe, as well. But I just was bringing the idea of princesses. Like, we all have a problem of, you know, Disney princesses in general. And he's trying to slice that. But is it her, if she had the choice to be a princess, would she be a or call herself a princess or some other, you know, a warrior or, you know, like,
I think it depends on poet. It depends on what you believe. And I, Estella, I want to know what you think. And again, Scott, you as well. Do you think that it was all in her head and it was a coping mechanism, or did it really happen? For me, I think it really happened because of the chalk that was on the table that she used to escape the room. the way that it was shot, I think that it does lend itself to that magical realism. But you could also read this movie as seeing a child deal with all this violence and trauma by creating another world to escape to. And when she gets shot and is murdered at the end of the movie, that's the last thing she imagines, her transcending into this other realm. But the deconstruction of princesses, could she choose to be something else? I don't know. I think she likes the concept of being a princess based on her love of fairy tales, right? Fairy like from the very beginning, if there's only one thing that she is a reader. If there's one thing she values, it's not dresses, as we saw when she went on the adventure with the bullfrog, it's books. I don't know what she would create, but I do think it hinges on whether you believe this movie in the world of the movie really occurred or if it was just a projection of a child that was traumatized.
I think the movie was created in such a way, and we know that, right, that there is no right and wrong answer to that. I think he wanted you to interpret that however you want. I believe everything that I saw was true because I want to, right? That is my choice. I will say that the princess thing, from the way that it was described, comes from a place of there is a father who loves you, who's waiting for you, and who's wanting you to return. There is a place for you. As someone who has witnessed displacement in a family, in society, just in general, seeing it through the lens of a little girl who has just been told, you are wrong. Everything is wrong with you. I think the title of princess lends itself more to having a place of your own and a kingdom of your own and a father who wants you. That story says that to her. And yes, I agree with Renzo. Books, which are my love language too, are more important to her than dresses. You know, that's very evident. But yes, I think it's true. I think all of it is true. And I believe wholeheartedly that her choice to be a princess is less about the flattery of being a princess and more about the place of having your own place in a kingdom and in a family with a father.
Hear, hear. I love it. It can't possibly be the latter, because then a princess becomes a queen who then could become a fascist ruler as well. So very, very, very well articulated there. To answer Renzo's question, yeah, I'd like to copy your answer. I choose to believe it as well, that it's real. I mean, I always oscillate between that kind of like science and faith, and, you know, whether it's more fun to believe it's real or richer. But yeah, I like to live in a world where anything from the imagination can become reality.
What about you, Renzo?
Well, I said it. I think that it's, I think it really happened, but I think it really happened because he left clues there in terms of like the chalk and how it appeared on his table. And like, there's no way it could have appeared on the table. Go ahead, Scotty.
You mentioned those things, but then the movie ends also with, from the fantasy world, we don't know really what has happened in the real world.
We don't know what happens in the real world. In the fantasy world, she rules for eons.
That's what I'm saying. In the real world, we don't know what happened to all the other characters that we've met.
Oh, if you studied history, you know what happened. They're all dead. They all got captured. They were all snuffed
Everybody
out.
Everybody has their own experience, you know, different characters. I wouldn't. Everybody, perhaps.
Very likely, right? Just in terms of what happened in Franco's Spain, like what they even mentioned it in the movie. They're like, we don't kill him because tomorrow there'll be somebody else. It just got so atrocious that they did something about it. It's about that stasis, right? And when you are in a moment of stress, is it about overcoming it or is it about surviving? I mean, I don't know. I think for me, reading the movie, again, I'm not the definitive, that's my opinion. You guys can read it another way. You can think Mercedes goes on to have adventures with Gabriel Garcia Bernal and Andor, right? But
I believe
I hope. Yeah, it'd be cool. But I think Pan's Labyrinth redefines disobedience as a moral virtue rather than a flaw, which is why it's more impactful that this act of rebellion is going to get them killed for me. I do want to begin wrapping this up because we're going to get to the poems. But when you relate to writing honest poetry in terms of disobedience, so the way that I went about, I was writing a poem. And it's a sonnet, but the sonnet has 14 lines in A, B, B, A, C, D, D, C, etc. rhyme scheme, iambic pentameter, you know, a volta around the ninth line or the ending couplet. three stanzas and a couplet, and it has all these formal rules. And when I was writing the sonnet, I'm like, okay, I know how to write a sonnet. So I'm writing the sonnet, but what I did at the end was break apart from it. And I left little clues in terms of breaking the meter here and breaking the meter there. And the reason that I'm sharing this is I don't really like to go in too much into why I write what I write or what goes on behind it. You guys know me, I tend to study classic forms and I like to deconstruct them and turn them and see if I can transcend the thing. But I think that rules are there to give us foundation, but true creativity comes when we use that as a platform to try to achieve something else. And the way that I see disobedience defined in Pan's Labyrinth, you mentioned the doctor. The doctor, I think Vidal asked him, like, why didn't you just obey? And he says something like, that's something you and people like you will never understand. And he dies. He gets murdered right then and there. For me, what I get from what Del Toro's trying to say with his morality play is that, you know, sometimes the law isn't justice. And to go along with things that are expected without thinking, without understanding the downstream effects of it, that is the real moral failing. And at times, disobedience is the highest form of morality we can achieve. That's what I get from the movie.
Much claps and snaps and cheers for me on that end. Critical thought, and as someone who was obsessed with that notion and also the idea of diffused responsibility, which I learned, you know, when I was getting my degree, I find that to be the highest form of integrity as a human being, to hold life and regard and see things from a perspective, not as you are given instructions or rules or parameters to work within, but as a human being with the autonomy to make those choices. A lot of the work that I do is based on that. We live in a world that gives us a lot of instruments and a lot of instruction, and having the ability to choose for yourself what's best for you and what sits well with you, and that disobedience, that rebel mentality, you know, I think it's framed like that, but it's essentially our given privilege living in a society where we can make choices for ourselves. So there are societies and cultures and places where you cannot. And it is a responsibility of us as people who can make choices to be discerning of those choices and to make the choices that align best with our own values. So I completely agree and could feel that as the theme throughout the entire movie. And most of his movies have a lot of that in them. That just because something has been so, or just because something is told to be so, doesn't necessarily mean that that is the right thing to do or to be.
That is especially true in Blade 2, my favorite Del Toro film. No, I love a lot of his stuff. So
Crimson,
are you guys...
Crimson Peak, one of my favorites.
Crimson Peak is fantastic.
Just to layer on that, I've kind of resolved to, they're happening at the same time. They're parallel. They're aspects of parallel universes, both happening at the same time, as opposed to one happening or not. That parts of each version are happening in tandem. There's some overlay, but they're happening together. That makes space for them both to exist. And maybe like the quote-unquote real world ends unhappily ever after, whereas hers is happily.
Great film, Stella. I'm really, you know, I really liked the other choice. I'm not going to say what the other choice was, but I really was looking forward to watching that movie. But I'm really glad that you chose Pan's Labyrinth. What I'd like to do now is just, would you guys like to hear some quick trivia about the movie, just in case we haven't gone over it, and then move on to the poems?
Absolutely. Let's do it. Please.
Del Toro refused larger Hollywood offers for this movie because he wanted to film in Spanish. By the way, guys, this film is in Spanish. Alteza. It is completely in Spanish, not in English, because he wanted to preserve the cultural authenticity. This is one of my favorite trivias about the movie, pieces of trivia. The film premiered at Cannes in 2006 and received a reported 22-minute standing ovation, which is still the longest in the festival's history.
More than the whale?
More than the whale. Wow. Doug Jones, who plays the Fawn and the Pale Man, he also played Abe Sapien in the Hellboy movies, and he was the creature in The Shape of Water, memorized his Spanish lines phonetically, even though he doesn't speak Spanish. And later his performance was dubbed while keeping his mouth movements. Like, his performance was so good, even though they went with another different actor, they kept the mouth movements, which is pretty cool. The movie won 3 Oscars, including Best Cinematography, and is sequently cited as one of the best films of the 21st century. It's definitely, I think, the best reviewed film of the early of the aughts. And the score is built almost entirely around a single lullaby that repeats in different variations, which I like because to me that mirrors the way a refrain works in a poem. So again, there's some poetry here.
Why don't I also read that the idea of the fawn did come from a nightmare from Guillermo del Toro about a fawn type figure.
I knew there was a method to the madness about the nightmare question.
Yes.
Look, if you guys have any trivia, feel free to jump in and share it too. But yeah, so why don't we move on to the poems? I would love to start with you, Stella. I'm just excited to hear what you wrote, what this movie inspired in you, seeing as how you brought it to our table. Pale Man Not Invited.
Pale Man Not Invited. The lullaby was such a beautiful thing to learn when I was also digging through the movie and the inspiration and all the things that the score was built around the lullaby over and over in different forms, which was really cool. Inspired, the poem is called The Lullaby. A dream within a nightmare, the wrong hand squeezed of its tenderness, a test as old as time, rituals leading to unknown lands. The lullaby, the crow's song, flying by the window. The agony of death lingers. The lullaby, tick-tock of the broken clock. A song of stern hostility, a song of cruel masculinity. Stone-cold heart and eyes that glare, mirror, mirror, the cracks are always there. The lullaby, the sound of fairies' wings fluttering, promises of a life beyond the sorrow, stories sweetening the ears of broken rebels, unwilling to accept their promised tomorrows. The lullaby, gunshots, blood spilled, courage in the face of death, protecting the sacred despite their goodwill. The lullaby finds its immortal audience among the trees, rooted, the earth beyond the labyrinth, a light in the cracks, time irrelevant, erased by the witness. Interconnected sentience, a truce found in eternal innocence.
That was lovely, Stella. Thank you for sharing that with us. Scott, do you have something you'd like to share today?
Snow White meets Snow Black. Oh, yeah. Mirror, mirror. I loved it, Stella. Thank you. Another tidbit, you know, Vidal, I'm sure you know, which means life-giving, which is the ultimate irony, whether he gave himself that name or what. I will say, both of you fluent in Spanish, I take it, whereas I am not. And the challenge of holding the baby, both averting his eyes, as well as reading the subtitles at the same time, was quite the juggling act, where I kept thinking about the pale man of one eye was on the movie, one eye was on the baby. I needed a third eye to like watch where his eye was so it wouldn't look at the movie at certain points. So I have two poems I will share. And in addition to kind of watching it, I was also kind of like cooking and cleaning a little while this was happening. Spanish, not my native language. I opened with a verse in Spanish. In el laberinto de nuestro apartamento, la cocina es mi bosque encantado. Por eso cocino y limpio con mucho cuidado. The spray had my magic wand as I double wash the dishes with my son, the Bonds. My wife might be the breadwinner, but I'm the hilador de pan. I slice and dice our fruits and vegetables with the sharpest knife, washing and hiding after use, as this was the same tool my brother-in-law used to take his own life. I may be an herbivore who's sure to store only forks and spoons. Call me Pale Man, attempting to cabbage patch past wounds. It's a pots and pans labyrinth where the stovetop's hot, and you are standing too close to the microwave. I've already lectured on the importance of oven mitts and how a freezer is like upstate when winter hits. As I can't help but imagine Jews sent to Siberia and those tragically left off Schindler's List. Like an uprooted mandrake is said to scream, I watch blender blades shredding berries into cream. Then serve it to my son with a straw for another smoothie movie review. At least for now, I prefer a Peter Pan's Labyrinth. Daddy likes to dress up in costumes just like you, plays on the playground and buys you something new. Thinking happy thoughts, at least for a few more years. Growing up is necessary, but violence like this, may your hearts and eyes steer clear.
Thank you, Scott. I like the rhyming between English and Spanish.
Right.
Lovely.
So let me do one other quick one. That this one I wrote the first time I watched it years ago. No. This one I wrote during the pandemic. You know, it alludes to Pan's Labyrinth. Speaking as we had been about nature during pandemic, the importance to being outside. And that's when I, you know, actually started cultivating plants with so many people dying, you know, outside. I wanted to give life and nurture as many, you know, plants as I possibly could. This one's just called Polygon Pan. Pan demi more is less of a math problem than 2 + 4, especially when playing golf with Bruce when rumor has it. Pan to Mickey Mouse is not the happiest place on any planet, and personal Space Mountain is none the wiser why the Magic Kingdom is out of sleight of hand sanitizer. Pan's Labyrinth amazes Borges facing a grateful dead end, but the imaginary friend doesn't know how to play pretend. Guillermo del Toro sushi tastes better than Guillermo del Taco. The shape of water chestnuts roasting on an umpire made me sick of El Chapo. Pacific Rim jobs taste more like Asperger's to Hellboy George, a devilish sex worker. Panda Express serves Bam Bootsy Collins, fo-fo. After singing, he'd rather be with Sun Tzu than General So. Orange chicken is the new black and bat. Egg steamroll sales have fallen flat. But the free samples on the used toothpicks have resulted in huge tips. Pancake Boss is a flapjack of mall trades, a chef, thief, security guard, and product tester. They've recently christened the food court jester. Batter up, cheese an oven bottom and a stove top. So whenever I can't run to a Waffle House, I hop.
Woo! I want pancakes now.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Midnight pancakes coming up.
That's right. Yes. We can have Brenner. You guys are down for Brenner?
Yeah.
My poem is called Pan's Hollow. It's an ekphrastic poem after Pan's Labyrinth in the style of Federico Garcia Lorca. Our inner world is a labyrinth, twisting into secrets, hidden passages and moonlit valleys. And the moon, light as a whisper, flows beneath what we do not say and what we do not leave open. And what we do not dare to dream in the hollow left unspoken. Two worlds exist in place of one. Two suns rise and race past the dawn above two worlds that move along, but there is only one moon. Gone. Gone after truth to find the voice, the voiceless morn in haunted fields, where rivers shed their rocky skin and bleed into the raging seas. Bleed, rage, race. Move, say, dream, twist and whisper. Escape the maze inside. Reach for the moon's beloved gaze, and through the fire, yourself will rise.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. The Thank wow jumps over the moon. I love it.
The river of blood leading to the oceans. Love it.
Hey, well, Stella, will you bless us with another one of your poems?
Thanks, Ron. So I will. I tried to pick a poem that would be the most in line with the movie and the themes. And when we first talked about doing this, this is the poem that came to mind. And then when I reread them, I was like, yeah, this is it. My first gut check was right. This is called Aware. In the outskirts of my mind, I find whispers tucked between the lines. They speak in languages I don't recognize, but the accent is somewhat familiar. As if I've spoken those words before, there's a richness to them, a cadence I can follow. In the outskirts of my mind, I find ruins of castles left behind. There are stones more ancient than time. In the outskirts of my mind, I can feel a presence, something that knows me. It lingers, observing, waiting for me to make choices. honoring my visions, my heartfelt decisions. In the outskirts of my mind, I find traces of civilizations. I've been a student of their education. I reach the outskirts of my mind and find a knowing gaze. I am aware.
Thank you, Stella. Everyone, that was Stella Amador. Stella, could you please tell us where we can find you on social media, where we can, anything that you want to promote that's coming up?
Yes. Thank you, Renzo. And thank you, Scott. I am excited for the 6-month anniversary of Wild Bloom Poetry, which is happening on December 12th. But I'm also super excited for next year. Programming has been expanded. I am working with Huizinga Park to design and create spaces that bring in poetry, culture, and community to enrich lives and connect us to nature. So on January 24th, we will be doing a Wild Bloom Poetry Showcase where actually you guys are invited to join me on stage. And we've been talking about this for the past couple of weeks and show what's possible with poetry and how we can build community through poetry and interconnect with nature and show what we can do. So I'm excited to have that as the beginning of a partnership with Huizinga Park. After that, I'm going to be doing the first and second Wednesday at Huizinga Park programming an open mic as well as a Poetry in the Park workshop series. And then, of course, on the third Wednesday, I am at Emily's Garden with Wild Bloom Poetry open mic, which is my standard, but very excited. All really good things. I'm also going to be at the Broward County Library on January 10th doing a workshop called Rooted Words in time for their Art Lit programming. So next year seems to be very busy and I'm excited for all of it.
As you should be, as you should be. Could you please tell us where we can find you on the Soch? Anything you want to throw our way there, where we can buy your book?
Oh yeah, that was part of the last question, which I went on to other things. At Bloom by Stella on Instagram, at Wild Bloom Poetry. And my company is Bloom by Stella. So bloombystella.com is where you can find Plant Your Life Planner. It is my debut book, the heart and soul of the work that I do.
Wonderful. Will there be an audiobook?
Plant Your Life Planner, Plant Your Days, which is next, by the way. Thank you for that segue. Plant Your Life Planner is the foundation. It is a series. The next book is Plant Your Days Planner, which is a companion. There is no audiobook for this yet. It is something that is meant as a physical guide. We live in an increasingly digital world, and I purposely wanted it to be something that is tangible, like the lives that we're living. There is a psychological connection with actual writing and holding something and the intentionality of it. So for right now, no. I will not say never, because never say never, but for at the moment, that's not part of the intention.
Thank you again, Stella, for joining us, keeping it real with the real poets. As you sign off, what is one way that you keep it real in your life, in your day-to-day?
My animals. They ground the heck out of me. I am amazed and inspired, and I laugh a lot with them. And I take a lot of breaks because they're part of my life and I work from home. So that's a way that I keep things real. It doesn't get any more real than having a bird on your head. Thank you guys for having me. This has been such a lovely conversation and a really amazing exercise. Like I said before, I don't usually write on a prompt, but this was really fun. Thank you for having me, for letting me pick this movie and for indulging me. Scott, thank you for watching it through all the trouble of like having to shield your child as you're watching this, adult fairy tale. Renzo, thank you also for your thoughtfulness, for putting this together and for inviting me, both of you. I admire you both. I love your poetry. So see you on the next side.
Stella, you have been a breath of fresh air for the community. You are proving to be a really great friend, and I just love having you around. I love chatting with you and discussing these things. I love your boyfriend's mane, his beautiful hair. And it's been really great not only collaborating with you, but just developing a friendship with you. And I think that One of the things that I love about you is your love for community, your mission to provide the space for others. And I can't wait to see, this is going to be corny, I can't wait to see where you bloom next. No, I can't wait to see what you do next. We're excited. Thank you very much for joining us for Real Poets. I have been Renzo del Castillo.
Scott 3T's Raven.
And remember to always keep it real.
Keep it real.
Real.
Real Poets is produced and hosted by Renzo del Castillo and Scott Raven. Original music composed by Gabby Weitzenfeld. Episode art and visuals by the Real Poets team. New episodes come out every other Thursday. Hit subscribe, download the episode, and leave a review to help us grow. This has been a Real Poets production. And remember to always keep it real.